Duck, duck, goose!
It's duck season, and I play fire!
It's the Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and this is the second Duck of Minerva podcast. Today, I will be interviewing Phil Arena, who is an assistant professor of political science at SUNY Buffalo. Phil maintains an excellent academic blog called FP Arena, which can be found at fparena.blogspot.com. Unfortunately, I need to begin today's podcast with an editorial announcement. We suffered some technical difficulties while recording the interview, and this has two implications. First, you'll likely hear a persistent hiss during portions of the interview. I've been able to reduce its annoyance factor, but not eliminate it altogether. Second, and much more important, is if you listen carefully, aspects of the interview might strike you as disjointed. The reason is that Skype was really acting up while we recorded the interview. Try as we might, we could not establish a stable connection. And significant portions of the interview were simply lost to clipping and other artifacts. So what I've done is I've taken the usable audio that we have, and I've stitched it together into what I hope is a fairly coherent whole. So what you're going to hear Phil talk about today are a few things. He'll discuss the epistemology of formal modeling. He'll talk a little bit about what it's like to be a formal modeler in the field of international relations. And then he'll discuss some ongoing work, including work that deals with how economic performance interacts with the chances of civil war. And also some work that looks at why the theoretical explanations that we have for the democratic peace, for why autocracies don't often fight one another, and for why democracies tend to win the wars that they fight are inconsistent with one another. There are a bunch of other issues that we either did cover or would like to cover, including what it's like to be an assistant professor who blogs and other kinds of issues, but we will have to wait for a future interview to discuss those. So that's it. Without further ado, here's the podcast. All right. So this is Dan Nexon, and I've got Phil Arena on the line. Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a fourth-year assistant professor at the University of Buffalo, and I study international conflict with a focus on the application of bargaining models to the study of international conflict. Sometimes looking particularly at domestic politics, sometimes looking more broadly at the international system under more traditional unitary actor type assumptions.
Are there any things in particular that you're working on right now, specific papers or specific collaborative work that you'd like to talk about?
I think it might be more useful to talk initially about the uses of formal modeling, and then as my work might tie in, that would probably be the best way to do it.
That sounds great.
Okay, so I think the way I would want to start off as I think there's a broad misunderstanding of what the goal of formal modeling is broadly, not just in IR specifically. So I'll get a little more specific in a few minutes. But just to start initially, I think political scientists writ large have a hard time understanding why you would even want to use a formal model at all. And I think part of this confusion does come from the fact that there are divisions among formal modelers over how we would use formal models. And I would suggest people who are interested in the topic take a look at the recent book by Primo and Clark, A Model Discipline, that discusses the uses of theoretical and empirical models. But without going into too much detail about the points they make, what I would say is that you could, loosely speaking, group formal modelers, not just in IR, but in political science and economics, for that matter, more broadly, into roughly two camps. And one group is interested in using formal models to really gain leverage on how the world that you and I live in works in a way where we would hope that the output actually does have some level of predictive power, postdictive power, or strong explanatory power, and really fits empirical reality nicely, if not perfectly. And the other group, or the other use, and different people can switch back between the two uses. I shouldn't make it sound like it's a camp. The other use is to answer abstract questions where you're not necessarily trying to claim that by answering this question you've gained leverage on the world that you and I live in. And so that one way to think about this, that Ariel Rubinstein, a prominent economist who does a lot of work with formal models, discusses, which ties, I think, nicely into the previous podcast we had with Patrick, is that formal models are basically a way of telling stories. They're a way of thinking through logically the further implications of a set of assumptions. So the way Patrick was talking about science fiction novels, you create an artificial world and you say, if this is how the world works, and it's stylized and it's not perfectly realistic, but it captures some important element of reality, what would we expect to observe? Well, that's basically what formal modelers are doing in at least some of our work. Of course, the difference, as Patrick discussed in your previous podcast, is with science fiction novels, there's a good story, and you can get undergrads to read it and pay attention. With formal models, it's buried in math that nobody wants to look at. But in essence, it's doing a very similar thing and saying, if the world was this simple, and we know it's not, what would we see? And sometimes that's interesting simply because the conclusions are surprising. And this can be useful for a variety of purposes, but it's mostly a logical exercise. And the claim that what we get out of that can't be tested or doesn't survive empirical testing sort of misses the point, because that was never the purpose in the first place in that second application. So there are formal modelers who would want to use formal models to gain leverage on and a better understanding of reality. But sometimes all we're after is a thought experiment.
So I'm wondering, because there are criticisms of each kind of approach, as you put it, and I think it's useful for you to point out that formal modelers may do work in either idiom. But one of the criticisms of the first approach tends to be, you know, as you've talked about on your blog, and I think you've probably had infinite number of discussions about, you know, is the claim that the assumptions that underlie a lot of formal models are patently unrealistic, right? Whether that's about human decision-making processes or structural environments, structural settings, social context, et cetera, right? So on the one hand, you know, people say of the first approach, you know, this is not, you know, the assumptions are not realistic. The second approach, which seems to get you out of that problem, you know, it has much in common, for example, with Weberian ideal type methodology, is to say, okay, but then what really is this good for other than kind of normative political theory? So I was wondering what you thought of both those of those criticisms as applied to those different understandings of what models are good for.
Right. That's a great question. So for the first one, I would say I think there is some validity to that, but I think it can be oversold. So one way to think of it is I just made it sound like it's two ideal types, but we could alternatively think of it as sort of a continuum of how close to reality are you trying to be. And I guess what I would say is if you want to be able to predict the decision that a specific person will make tomorrow, then your theoretical model better be very, very realistic. And that's when I think the criticisms that the assumptions that are typically made in this literature aren't very, very realistic, have real bite. The further you move away from that end of the continuum so that you're looking at a more abstract level and trying to capture a big picture view of reality and not necessarily predict specific events at specific times by specific individuals, the less I'm troubled by the concern that the assumptions are not perfectly realistic. And so one thing that I like to say is when people say, well, your assumptions aren't realistic, my response is often, well, tell me a story about why the fact that I have simplified reality would bias me in favor of arriving at the conclusion I've arrived at. If you've got a story there, and often you do, then there's a problem with my model. If the way I've simplified reality treats things that are often true as always true, or makes things completely unrealistic, but in such a way that it should make it even harder for me to arrive at my conclusion, then all I've done is saved on math, and nobody wants more math for the sake of more math. So I guess my point is, it's easy to say the assumptions aren't realistic, but we need to ask, are the unrealistic assumptions making it easier to prove what was proven without a 50-page appendix, or are they actually driving the result in a way that should make us skeptical of the argument? Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah, it makes some degree of sense. I actually think it's interesting. I want to back up for a second, because sure. The way that you began this conversation is to say, you know, before you wanted to get into the specific things that you do research on, you wanted to clarify about, you know, kind of views about the purposes of formal models. And that signals to me that you might feel, or that people who do the kind of work that you do might feel, as if you're under assault or under attack by the broader field. I mean, what do you think the positionality is, or the position is, of formal modeling within international relations right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think I do come across that way, and I've met people, particularly people whose methodologies are very heavily under attack, who find it strange to hear somebody who uses a method that's seen as prestigious as coming from that position. So I want to clarify, I do think that formal modelers are something of a minority, but I don't want to suggest a false equivalence with any number of different approaches that are really on the fringes of the field. So if you want to talk of sort of a hierarchy of oppression or something, if you want to use such terms, then I'm not saying we're at the bottom of the poll. But I think there's a perception that some people have that there's the numbers people and the not numbers people, and the numbers people run this discipline. And I think that's a little simplistic. I think this discipline is dominated by what Patrick would call neo-positivists, who are predominantly quantitative scholars. And quantitative scholars are perhaps more comfortable with formal theorists than critical theorists or normative theorists or qualitative research, but they don't get it. They maybe think that it's prestigious, and they think it's closer to being quote-unquote science, which, as Patrick discusses, is a very problematic notion. But I don't think it's really understood. And so I guess what I'm saying is, when I submit my papers to mainstream journals, they don't immediately say this method can't be useful, which I think there are people in this field who are running into that, and that's really unfortunate. But what they do is they say, well, here's an assumption that's not true, therefore I didn't learn anything from this paper and I reject it. And so there's just a starting assumption that's potentially useful, but any given application, I don't get it, and there's assumptions that I don't believe, so clearly this isn't a paper I shouldn't publish. So if you don't have a certain reputation already, it's very hard to get formal work past quantitative people.
And this is the reason I pressed you on this issue was precisely because I wanted to hear if that was the case. I think there is a widespread perception among people who think of themselves as non-mathematical people that there's sort of non-mathematical or qualitative work, and then there's all that stuff that uses math.
Right.
And if you use math, that automatically means you have an easy time of it. And I don't think that's true for people who are doing really any kind of work. I mean, whether it's behavioral, statistical, and then particularly if it's work that's, you know, in the formal modeling idiom. I mean, one of the things, this is maybe, you know, before your time, but I remember back in the late 80s, and particularly in the early 90s, there was a real kind of sense among people who now we might identify as constructivists, who are self-identified as constructivists, of, or even people who were self-identified as qualitative. I mean, actually, it's not fair at all to say they're constructivists. A lot of these people were sort of, you know, qualitative security people. Think about Steve Walt's rigor mortis piece. You know, that it was going to be a big fight between, you know, the qualitative people and the formal modelers. And the formal modelers were the enemy, and they were the people who were going to drive out the kind of work that qualitative people did. And I look back and I think this is just really hilarious. Because, you know, it wasn't at all if you were somebody who was going to tell stories in English rather than in math, and you were worried about your field, the field going in a different direction, it turns out, and I think it was pretty obvious at the time, that it wasn't formal modeling that was going to be taking up journal space. It was going to be, comparative analysis using you know, math, i.e. statistical analysis.
That's right.
And I don't think, you know, I talk to people in the field and I don't think they've quite caught up to this notion. They still think that, you know, it's really easy to publish a game theoretic piece of work, or that it's easy to get a job as a game theorist. And I'm not sure that either of those are the case, and it doesn't sound like it is.
Right. And again, I don't want to suggest that the bias against formal modelers is equivalent to the bias that qualitative people or constructivists or feminists might be facing, because I don't think it's equivalent. I do think it's true that quantitative people look at formal work as prestigious in a certain way, but they don't really quite understand it. And it is sort of a cliquey crowd. And so if you come from the right program and you know the right people, it maybe is easier to place your work. But I've come from a program that's known as producing quantitative people, and it took me a while to convince formal people that I speak their language and I can do what they do.
So what you're saying, in other words, is that like any genre of international relations, research and methods, I put my sentence in the wrong order. What you're saying is that formal modeling is no different than any other genre of international relations theory or methodology or research, you know, that it has its cliques, its inside and its outside, its hierarchy of prestige, and its challenges if you're doing work in that idiom.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Let's get beyond the sort of sociology of the field and get back to sort of you know, substantive implications or substantive aspects of the work that you do.
Sure.
So you said that having that first orienting your work within this continuum of, you know, work that is laying out this continuum of work that's sort of modeling for modeling's sake, and then modeling as an attempt to get close to the reality of decision making processes or foreign policy processes or international relations processes in general, would be important because it would help us to understand some of the work that you're doing. So I was hoping that maybe we could talk about some of the work you're doing in that context.
Sure. So as an example of trying to actually use a foreign model to gain leverage on the real world, I have one paper I'm working on now on civil war, which substantively is not my normal area of expertise, but it's with a grad student who's interested in that, and I saw a potential application theoretically that interested me. And so here we have the basic puzzle is there's a long line of work in quantitative studies of civil war that emphasizes the importance of GDP per capita. And we don't quite know exactly why GDP per capita matters. One interpretation is that it's grievances, but people have started to sort of move past that. But as a stylized account, you could say that poor countries experience civil wars because people are unhappy and they want to overthrow their governments. And the basic take with our paper is, well, it might make sense to say that if there's an ongoing rebellion, being unhappy would explain willingness to participate. But if governments are strategic, then they ought to understand that people are more likely to join an ongoing rebellion when they're really unhappy. And this ought to influence how they negotiate with the would-be leaders of any given rebellion. And so we look at a relatively simple bargaining model where we first ask, how does the level of grievances among the population influence bargaining between the elites who would lead a rebellion if there is to be one, and the general populace? And then higher order, how does anticipation of those dynamics influence bargaining between the government and the leaders of any potential rebellion? And what comes out of our model theoretically is that when violence against the government would be likely to have popular support, it should actually be less likely to occur in the first place. And then we do quantitative statistical analysis to assess that implication of the model and actually do find some support that wealthy countries are in fact more likely to experience civil conflict than poor countries. They're just far less likely to have the conflicts they experience become more severe and more popular. And so we find that full-scale civil wars are more likely in poor countries, but overall, the probability of peace, of having no civil conflict of any kind, is somewhat lower in rich countries than in poor countries.
Hmm.
And so we think that that's an interesting implication of the theoretical model that does seem to have some, there does seem to be some evidence of the implication that comes from the model in the historical record. Now, we can quibble about the statistics and maybe think the data we've used have problems, but, you know, if we take as given that our statistical evidence supports the observable implication of the theoretical model, that would be an example where we use the model to say there, it's clearly stylized to say there's the government, the rebel elites, the population. All those actors can be disaggregated. We make a lot of simplifying assumptions about what people know and what they want, and I wouldn't defend them as realistic. What I would say is I think that if we made the world more realistic in a lot of those ways, we would probably still find the same mechanism, but we'd have to go through a lot more math to get there. And so I'm reassured by the fact that we do actually seem to observe this non-trivial insight in the historical record.
Well, that's really interesting and clearly has widespread implications for, as you say, ongoing debates in the Civil War literature, but also for, you know, kind of policy claims about, you know, development being the key to ending civil wars and so on and so forth. Are there any other major projects that you have going on right now?
Sure. So at the other end of the continuum, to answer the question from before, of when would we be interested in a model that we don't think is particularly realistic, I have a couple of projects that are looking at domestic politics and international conflict. And the questions I'm trying to answer in a couple of different related papers are basically saying, going back to the 90s, we have this literature that we're all familiar with from comps, and many of us probably tried to forget after that, on the democratic piece, where we know that as a stylized fact statistically, pairs of democracies are come into conflict with one another with less frequency than other pairs of states. And we don't know whether that's causal or not, but it's hard to dispute that it is actually the case that conflict occurs less frequently than that pair.
I'm losing you again. Hey Phil, you're cutting out again.
Okay.
Okay, now you sound okay. Why don't you go back to what you were saying, and I can, you know, edit this later.
Sure. So I was saying we have established as a stylized fact that pairs of democracies are less likely to come into conflict with one another than other pairs of states. And we don't know whether that's causal or not, but it's pretty clear that conflict occurs with a low frequency among pairs of democracies. And since this pattern was established in the late 80s and early 90s, there have been a number of prominent attempts to explain why it would be so in hopes of convincing people that it is, in fact, a causal explanation. What I'm doing in a number of papers is saying, well, the logical implications of the theoretical arguments that have been developed to account for this empirical regularity aren't quite what we realize them to be. And once we look more deeply at what would have to also be true if these things were true, we should start to realize that maybe we're not so comfortable with these explanations at. But the extent that people are more convinced that it's causal because we thought we had, quote unquote, good theoretical explanation for it, the further we see that those theoretical explanations are actually fairly problematic, the more we might want to step back and say, maybe we shouldn't be so confident in saying this is causal because we have a good story, because maybe we don't actually have such a good story.
Could you give a specific example of a mechanism from the democratic peace argument that you think is problematic and why?
Sure. So one of the papers that I'm working on shows that there are three empirical regularities that are often lumped together in this literature. One is that democracies don't fight each other. One is that democracies do fight autocracies. And one is that democracies win the wars they fight against autocracies. And I am not aware of any theoretical argument that would lead me to believe all three of those things simultaneously. And most of the major explanations of the democratic peace logically imply that one of those other two empirical regularities cannot be true. And so that's what I'm saying is a big problem. So most of the explanations why democracies don't fight each other suggests that we should observe more wars between pairs of autocracies than any other pairing, which is clearly not what we observe. We observe wars most frequently between autocracies and democracies. So if democracies don't fight each other because they're very good at revealing information, and we think information problems are a primary cause of war, going back to Fearon, then if democracies are the most transparent and autocracies are the least transparent, then autocracy-autocracy pairing should be very conflict-prone, and yet they're not. And that's problematic for that explanation of the democratic peace, would be an example of how a purely theoretical argument can shed insight that I think is non-trivial, but is not fundamentally empirical in its own contribution.
And what about with respect to the democratic victory argument? Can you elaborate a contradiction between, you know, mechanisms in one of those sets and that particular argument?
Sure. So one of the more recent attempts to explain the democratic peace that I think is actually quite interesting, Debs and Gomans had an APSR. They don't spell this out, but I've played around with very similar models and played around with their model, and it's not too hard to show that the mechanism they articulate for why democracies don't fight each other can explain why democracies don't fight, why democracies do fight autocracies and autocracies don't fight each other too often. But their model suggests that democracies should be unlikely to win the wars that they fight. They don't identify this in their article, but if you trace through the logic, basically their story is that autocrats are more sensitive, contrary to what most people believe, to the outcome of a war in terms of their ability to remain in office. Democrats are unlikely to remain in office even after winning a war, and so winning or losing a war doesn't matter a whole lot to Democrats, according to Debs and Gomans, but it does matter to autocrats. If autocrats win wars, they're guaranteed to stay in power. If they lose wars, they're still pretty likely to stay in power, but it's a big difference, and a bigger difference than you would see for Democrats, who are pretty much always insecure.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, autocrats are going, if they expect that they could lose a war, they need to be offered pretty minimal concessions in order to avoid the war. If they know that allowing this dispute over territory, say, to escalate to violence could mean a conflict that they could very well end up losing, and that would not just mean losing the territory, but losing hold on power, they're going to be willing to give away the farm in order to avoid that fight. In contrast, when they expect to be... So as I was saying, autocrats, according to Debs and Gomans, are in fact more sensitive to the outcome of the war. And this surprised people because we think of Democrats as being punished for losing wars. What we forget is Democrats don't get to remain in office when they win wars. And if you think of Churchill or Bush, then this starts to become more intuitive. So for an autocrat who otherwise expects to remain in office for a long time, the difference that the outcome of war can make can be big. For a Democrat, you don't expect to remain in office even if you win wars, so it doesn't make a big difference in relative terms. As a result, Democrats basically negotiate over territory looking at the fair value of the territory. Autocrats are thinking also about the political implications of more than fair value because he expects to lose, and so we don't expect a conflict. When we have a Democrat negotiating with a Democrat, they negotiate based on the fair value. We don't expect a conflict. When an autocrat who expects to lose a war over territory is negotiating with a Democrat, he's going to give away way more than he needs to, and the Democrat's going to be very happy, and they're not going to have to fight. When an autocrat expects to win a territorial war against a Democrat, he wants huge concessions, and the Democrat doesn't see any reason to give them up, and a war happens, and the autocrat wins. So it's not that regime type explains winningness in war per se. It's that regime type explains which types of wars are likely to occur in the first place, and wars that ought to favor Democrats for military reasons or other reasons are not especially likely to occur. Wars that would disfavor Democrats, that is, favor autocrats, are likely to occur.
So I see why you describe this as a kind of logical exercise, and I think it's a fairly powerful criticism of a set of these mechanisms. But I say that I see why you see it as a logical exercise, because when I start thinking about things like the Democratic victory, I start really thinking about the quality of the statistics, the actual cases that are involved, and why this finding isn't sure. necessarily all that interesting or robust, right? So, you know, we're talking about a rather small number of wars, of conflicts.
Absolutely.
We're talking about some conflicts that were much nearer things than, you know, if you think about the really big wars between great powers, not the, you know, U.S. beats up on small Caribbean island style conflict. You know, you're actually talking about wars that could have gone the other way.
Yes.
And so, you know, from that perspective, you know, you might say, well, okay, well, why does this really matter? But I can really see from the argument about the mechanisms and how thinking logically through the implications of the mechanisms, you know, you can really gain a lot of purchase by being really precise in the way that formal modeling allows you to do. So that sounds to me like a pretty powerful set of arguments. Are these all still in progress, or have you gotten any of these to the publication stage?
No, these are all still in progress.
And I'm sorry to say that the interview ends on that rather sudden note. This has been Duck of Minerva, podcast number 2, recorded 27 July 2012.